From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. In 2017, we spoke with Ellis Marcellus Jr., who as a piano player and educator made extraordinary contributions to modern jazz. But at times, he was reluctant to focus on himself.
Thinking about my life is kind of an egotistical luxury.
In a city known for traditional jazz, Marcellus helped create a space for musicians to play differently. Marcellus died in April at the age of 85. He told us how important childhood friendships were to the artist he became.
And when it comes to the human beings that contributed to your personal development, you only can do that when they pass away. And you reflect on what it was like when you knew them.
Ellis Marcellus Jr., after the break. Looking back, the whole story fits into place neatly, as easy to follow as the alphabet. Of course, Ellis Marcellus Jr. would be born in New Orleans during the Depression and begin playing piano at the age of 13. Of course, he would love jazz of the 1940s and 50s, particularly bebop. Of course, he would play and record with like-minded musicians in the city. And it's no stretch of the imagination to believe that Marcellus and his wife Dolores would raise 6 children, and he would inspire them as a musician and as a teacher. He'd have other students, of course. Of course he would. Terrence Blanchard, Harry Connick Jr., Donald Harrison Jr., among others. It's entirely logical that most of Marcellus's sons would become influential jazz musicians. So much so that the entire family would be honored by the National Endowment for the Arts and the U.S. Postal Service as the first family of jazz. Looking backward, it all makes sense. But of course, life happens when people are looking in the opposite direction, and no achievement is guaranteed. That's what makes the Marcellus story all the more exciting to explore. Ellis Marcellus joins us here at Marini Studios. Welcome, and thanks so much for coming out.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You know, this is a favorite neighborhood of mine anyway, Faubourg Marini.
That I believe. There's an institution with which you are very closely associated, the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, I guess, beginning in 1974.
Right. I was there for 12 years. Yeah. the NOCA that is now in existence in its next incarnation, if you will, is a state institution, and it's a comprehensive school, which means that students who go there take art courses as well as non-art courses, you know, the science and the history and the English. The NOCA that I taught was Uptown New Orleans, Orleans Parish Public School. It was not a comprehensive school. We had 5 disciplines: music, theater, dance, creative writing, and visual arts. And that was kind of enough for us.
Well, I tell you what, looking back, well, first of all, let me ask you this. I mean, you were playing so beautifully. Do you feel like you want to finish that song?
I did. It has an interesting history.
And this is a song called Syndrome.
Right. I wrote this song when I was teaching at NOCA, and I had a guitar student. I was trying to figure a way to set up some chord changes, as we call them, some harmony, for him to improvise on. So I just would like, and start all over again. And just we would do that over and over and over. Because I played piano, I would interact with the students to get them the experience of improvisation.
Wow, that's really beautiful. It's really, I could just listen to that for the rest of the interview, to be honest with you, but now I'm going to make you talk. So looking back, you know, over your life, does it seem like one life to you, or does it break down into lots of different lives that you think you've lived?
Well, I think the older I get, I see it as one life. But in trying to explain, even to explain to myself, how did you get to where you are at this time? I have to break it up in bits and pieces, so to speak, and look at different people who were influential, and then try and think of what did they contribute towards what you do. I remember when I first met Edward Blackwell, who's a fantastic drummer. And would go over to his aunt's house and play as a piano very similar to this piano.
The stand-up, beautiful piano.
You know, and I always used to wonder, I said, why'd you call me? Because at that time, you know, my piano skills was not that strong. I wasn't really sort of a dedicated pianist. You know, he said, well, man, all the other piano players is tied up.
You know. Now that's a compliment.
So, you know, anyway, it started a relationship that lasted. And when it comes to the human beings that have contributed to your personal development, you only can do that when they pass away. And you reflect on what it was like when you knew them.
Right.
So when I think about my life, which I don't do too much of, I don't think about it too much now. It's just that there are things that I have to do, need to do, have started and need to complete, so that thinking about my life is kind of an egotistical luxury, which I don't have.
But I'd like to encourage it for right now. Hmm? I'd like to encourage that egotistical luxury.
Oh, well, I can, you know, there are things that I can still talk about in relationships in my life.
And so you take up musical instruments, you know what I mean, from the very young age as a teenager. And in, you know, the 40s and the 50s, this was, particularly the 40s, this was a time of a real renaissance in New Orleans traditional jazz, but you're moving in another direction. And so what ideas were you hearing that appealed to you at that time?
Music has to speak to you. I don't care what kind of music it is. It can be pop music, rap, jazz, classical music, whatever. It has to speak to you. The more challenging it is to your ear, maybe the longer it takes for you to get it, so to speak. I used to listen to the radio station. There was only one radio station in New Orleans that played music. Call letters, WJBW.
What do you mean? There was only one radio station that played music?
That's right.
All the radio stations played music.
No, they didn't.
They didn't?
No. See, the precursor of television were radio shows, the whole sequence on Sundays with Fred Allen, Amos and Andy, Jack Benny, all of that.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we bring you our master of ceremonies, a man
Hold
who...
it, Don, hold it. Just a minute. Jack isn't here yet.
Well, where is he?
Well, he's out in the hall talking to Orson Welles on the telephone.
You know, I was a big fan of the Lone Ranger and the Shadow and the Invisible Man. All of that stuff was on radio.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
Now, there were shows that had bands like Kay Kaiser and his musical Knowledge, which is a game type show with a band that played, and people would be contestants and guess what the song was. There was that.
Miss Edna Hazelhurst of St. Petersburg, Florida, wants to know if you know what the horse on the broken merry-go-round sang. Well, the horse on the busted merry-go-round sang...
But just from the standpoint of listening to music, there was one. It was WJBW, and very few of the black artists was played on WJBW.
Okay.
Maybe Louis Armstrong every now and then, but it wasn't until somewhere around in the 50s that you started to hear WMRY catering primarily to rhythm and blues, and eventually WBOK, I don't know when they came online.
Right, right.
And
but there you were as a youngster, just beyond the tween years, and you're listening to JBW, WJBW, and what are you hearing that is challenging your ear?
Well, everything pretty much was challenging my ear at that time, because I was 10, I think. Because, see, at the age of 10, my father bought this property in Jefferson Parish. That would have been 1944. The world was changing. Not that I understood any of that at that time. But the radio was still basically what I listened to. And I was in a very rural area for 2 years. The school that I went to was called Shrewsbury School. Of course, at that time, segregation was still in vogue. And sixth grade was on one side of the room. Seventh grade was on the other side of the same room. So I didn't learn a lot as a result of that. Fortunately, they didn't have eighth grade. So my father was still managing a filling station at that time in Orleans Parish. And about 6 or 8 blocks from that was a school called F.P. Rickard Elementary School. So I used to use his address to go to Rickard, which was the best thing that ever happened for me. After I started at this school at Rickard, they had a band, a school band, and we used to play like little marches. And that's when music was consistent to me, not just what I had heard on the radio, but actually participating. And I started taking clarinet lessons at the Xavier University Junior School of Music. While I was there, I heard this guy playing some chords and stuff. I didn't know what that was.
He was playing what instrument? Piano?
Piano.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he actually played the violin in the orchestra.
Xavier's Junior School of Music Orchestra.
Right.
Okay.
So I went in the big room where the piano was, and I just asked him, I said, man, what is that? So he said, come on, sit down on the other end. So he showed me how to play this. Just that, over and over and over again, while he was soloing up in the upper register.
Hmm.
So I still didn't have no idea what he was doing. But it was intriguing to me to hear this. And, it was a bit-by-bit situation. There was a jazz station, but they were playing modern jazz, the stuff that was going on with Dizzy and Miles and Bird and all of them.
And that was here in New Orleans?
The station was. Now, this was somewhere around 1946, 47. And, I didn't understand all of it, but it appealed to me. It was challenging. ¶¶ By the time I started to listen to that, I had gone into high school. I started at Gilbert Academy, and they had what they call a swing band. Mm. And I told my mom, I said, man, I need to get a tenor saxophone. So my mom bought me a tenor saxophone, and I started playing in the swing band. But also, there was more rhythm and blues being played on the radio. I don't know when it exactly started. There was a guy who lived in New Orleans named Roy Brown.
Oh, sure. Good rocking tonight, Roy Brown.
Well, Roy was living in a house that was owned by the mother of a very good friend of mine, Roger Dickerson. And he was living right next door.
Well, I heard the news, there's good rocking tonight. Tonight she'll know I'm a mighty, mighty man. I heard the news, there's good rockin' tonight. Oh, yes, I heard the news.
And I learned that tenor solo, the guy who was playing it, they called him Batman. I don't remember his name. They just called him Batman. I don't know why, but I learned that solo. See, and it's another thing, see, when you can play those current pop solos like that, them girls start to look at you. You know, and that was not lost to me.
Well, sweet Lorraine, Sioux City, Sioux, sweet dog.
But at what point did you realize that the pieces were coming together, that what you were listening to was bebop, and that somehow this kind of music meant more to you than any other kind of music?
It was actually probably between the age of 13 and 16. When Dizzy Gillespie's big band came into New Orleans. This was in the spring of 1949, and I had heard some of that music on that radio station that played modern jazz, but I'd never heard a live band.
So do you remember any of the material that Dizzy Gillespie was playing around that time in the late 1940s? He may not have played it that night, but, I mean, that you heard him, but that essentially drew you in.
Oh, yeah, I remember because some of those pieces became important parts of the learning process that I would subsequently go through as I got older and begin to meet musicians.
Like what?
Like there's one piece called Things to Come. It's the fastest thing I ever heard in life. I never heard a thing that fast. That music spoke to me. You know, I don't know that I could really explain as to why it did. Because there were many people that I was around here in New Orleans who were playing music, and it just didn't speak to them. But I think when I heard Dizzy's band, I knew immediately that that's what I wanted to do, what they're doing up there.
That's Ellis Marsalis playing almost as fast on Swingin' at the Haven. Stay with us.
This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. In the years between age 10 and when he graduated from college and joined the Marines, Ellis Marcellus lived with his parents, just beyond the New Orleans city limits. Their land became a compound anchored by the family motel called the Marcellus Mansion. Beginning in the late 1940s, the Marcelluses catered to African-American travelers who had no place to stay in the segregated city. Many of their famous guests were of a musical variety.
Well, some people may be wrong sometimes, but they can't be wrong all the time. Like they say, a cat has nine lives, nine loves, have the woman of mine. And what can I do? So I know it's something.
I never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by, when you're in love, my, my, how they fly. Oh, blue days, all of them gone.
Young Ellis and his sister took piano lessons, and he also played clarinet. And with Dinah Washington, Ray Charles, and B.B. King passing through, that's a rockin' good time. In 2017, we asked Ellis Marcellus what his home sounded like.
Huh, that's interesting. I don't know. I don't think that there was much of a musical sound, per se, because my sister and I were the only people there with any musical interest in terms of formal study.
So this is fascinating that, you know, I mean, that you come from a non-musical family, and yet you and your sister were playing instruments.
Well, it was one of those things that parents send their children to take music lessons. It's one of them middle-class ideas. I started buying those 78 records of Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie. You know, basically, I worked on a lot of things based on what I heard on recording. When I was in school, jazz was like in the closet, so to speak.
Okay.
There were no teachers teaching, and it was not tolerated. Some school would put you out.
So after high school, you went to Dillard University here in New Orleans. And my understanding, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that was a very special time for you in the sense of making these connections with other musicians, people like Harold Batiste, people like Alvin Batiste and Ed Blackwell.
No, not Alvin. Alvin and I went to grammar school together.
Okay.
And he played the clarinet. Alvin, when we finished high school, Alvin went up to Southern University.
Yes.
And I went to Dillard. Now, Harold was at Dillard for a couple of years before I got there.
Harold Batiste, the sax player.
Mm-hmm. And he was like a mentor for me for a long time. I played the saxophone for a pretty good while. I didn't really grow as a saxophone player. The tenor saxophone was an introduction for me into the workspace of music and musicians. So I would play a job here, a job there, maybe on piano, sometimes saxophone. You know, it's kind of real disoriented, disorganized, helter-skelter kind of lifestyle. And eventually, I would start playing at the Dewdrop Inn. And there was one down in the Night Ward called Club Desire. I don't know how long that lasted.
Yeah, Fats Domino played Club Desire. And I think, obviously, the Dewdrop, I mean, up on LaSalle Street here in New Orleans, I mean, that was just a legendary and long-running club.
They used to have jam sessions on Sundays at the Dewdrop.
Well, okay, so what got you to playing piano?
Nathaniel Perelot.
Nathaniel Perelot.
When I went to this jam session and heard him, I knew that I was not going to play like that on a saxophone. I had been, you know, playing around with the piano and had some skills because I was fortunate enough to have a very, very good second piano teacher. Her name was Jean Costin Maloney. And she taught me the fundamentals. But when I heard Nathaniel, that was when I really started to think more and more about playing the piano as a main instrument. See, things were changing at that time. This would be right at about 1959 when I got out of the military. Then I got married that year. And because I always knew that the better you were at whatever it is that you were doing, it increases your chances of financial success, too. Even though New Orleans was definitely not a place to make any kinds of money with serious types of music, any kind.
Right.
If you played in the symphony, that was no money either.
Well, so you were part of an ensemble known as the American Jazz Quintet. And so who made up the quintet?
In the beginning, Edward Blackwell was the drummer. Harold Baptiste played tenor saxophone. Alvin Baptiste played the clarinet. And Richard Payne and or Chuck Beatty played bass. We did make a recording that was released on the AFO label.
To Brownie, take two.
This was a label that was begun by Harold Baptiste,
correct,
the sax player. It AFO stands for All for One.
Right.
What songs do you remember coming out of your early sessions with the quintet?
Oh, all of them. What's the name of that? Two Brownie? Is that Two Brownie?
Yep, Brownie. Exactly. There's one called Tony. There's one called...
Tony. Tony is mine. I wrote that.
Thank you.
invited up to Atlanta, Georgia, to play in Edward Blackwell Festival. Now, this would have been like 1988, because I was at Virginia Commonwealth. You know, I think it was close to my last year. And I was getting ready to sit down at the piano, and right on the top part of it was the music that Alvin had scratched out for us to rehearse. And I remarked to Harold, I said, man, I said, do you know everything that I know about music is in these songs right here? You know, not some classroom or none of that. So Harold, unbeknownst to me, Harold thought about that. And then he went home and he created what is now called a silver book. The songs that we played for the better part of 40 years.
So the American Jazz Quintet was a seminal group in the sense that there were an awful lot of modern jazz musicians coming out of that group, many that you've named. And those musicians went on to play with Ornette Coleman and Randy Weston and, you know, a whole variety of people, including Dr. John, even Sonny and Cher. Harold Batiste and other members moved west. You did spend some time out west, but ultimately returned to New Orleans. Why did you stay in New Orleans? Why stay permanently in New Orleans when this is not a modern jazz town necessarily?
Well, it's just that I couldn't put it together comfortably. I couldn't put that together. Because when I got out of the military, my plan, I take my mustering out pay, because when you leave.
Coming out of, you were in the Army, or?
I was in the Marines.
You were in the Marines. Okay, so you were a
Marine. This would have been in 58.
Okay.
So
okay.
It would have been a perfect time to do that. Throw my stuff in the trunk of the car and drive to New York from L.A.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do that.
So you pointed your car to New Orleans.
That's right.
And so did you feel pressure from your family?
Did you feel pressure from
anybody?
No.
So what do you think accounts for that decision?
I think that I was being spiritually guided above and beyond the decisions that I was making, which turned out to be the best thing for me to do.
The Ellis Marsalis Quartet with 12 Zit. Coming up, making spirits bright and some students cry. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. As Ellis Marsalis's family grew, he got busy teaching in New Orleans and away, opening a music club, closing a music club, touring with Al Hurt, leading his own combos. So by the 1980s, when his son's careers were taking flight, Marsalis was busy.
Things began to happen for me in the city of New Orleans. Like, I was playing at the Hyde Regency.
Yes.
And I was doing the cocktail hour, I guess you call it, you know, 5 to 7. I played with Clark Terry. I played with Eddie Lockdell Davis. And I was still teaching at Nunca during that time.
Right.
So I didn't really have the time to think in any celebratory manner of the kids. Because in some ways, on a smaller scale, I was doing the same thing that they were doing. Thank you.
You know, there came a point when you all began recording together. I mean, one of my favorite albums, actually, is Joe Cool's Blues. This was an album that featured the Ellis Marsalis Trio as well as the Wynton Marsalis Septet. And the Ellis Trio performed songs that were written by Vince Guaraldi, associated with Peanuts, the Peanuts cartoon.
Delvio produced that. It was really Wynton's album. See, Delvio called me and he said, "Hey, man, can you come over to the studio? I want you to do some Charlie Brown music."
And then with Branford Marsalis, you did just an extraordinary album called Loved Ones.
Oh, yeah. That was mine. That was a solo album it was supposed to be. And the more I worked on these pieces, I could hear Branford playing the melodies. So I just called him. I said, "Hey, man, look, come play on this, just me and you." Eventually did call it Loved Ones because it was all female type songs.
Yeah, I mean, each song bore the name of a woman.
Right.
Right.
And that was not intentional.
Really?
It wasn't. That's true, it really wasn't. It just worked out that way.
But then with Jason Marsalis, you've recorded a lot because he's a member of the Ellis Marsalis Trio. But I think with Jason and with Wynton Marsalis, you've recorded Christmas music.
We used to play at Mater Dela Rosa Church, our church, around Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, so they had a good piano over there too. So Jason would bring his vibraphones, and then we would play. After the mass, people would just stay, the ones who wanted to, and just listen to us.
Be a softie at heart.
Wow, I've been called a lot of names, but I don't know about that one.
You might be a softie. There's something kind of a little bit sentimental, you know what I mean? I'm often touched by how much kind of stout-heartedness goes into these songs. Yeah, and maybe a little bit of melancholy. Yeah. You know, that goes into these really beautiful sentimental songs. You know, do you notice, do you feel that? Do you feel a melancholy?
I did recognize at some point that I was more inclined to ballads than I was inclined to the breakneck speeds that we used to do when I was young. You know, we'd be playing a million miles an hour. And it became something that I could do because I had the technique to do it. But after a while, you know, it did not musically appeal to me.
Yeah, maybe you wanted to say something else. let's turn a little bit to your teaching philosophy and your teaching career. Well, a number of your students, I mean, what you've had so many, those from New Orleans include, what, Terrence Blanchard and Donald Harrison and Harry Connick Jr. and, of course, Nicholas Payton and all. But many of your students at NOCA, the students at the University of New Orleans's jazz program at Virginia Commonwealth, you mean, they've described you and your teaching method by saying that it was somewhat ego-crushing.
Mm-hmm.
For the students, you know, that that you could be brutally honest in a way that could actually spark a few tears.
I just saw a kid like that, and he was sharing a lot of that with me about tears and and how hard I was on him.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's a quote saying, he was really honest with me, brutally honest, to the point when I was actually crying at the end of rehearsal. To this day, I appreciate that.
Yeah. You have to gauge. And there were students who would come to us and say, you know, I don't think performance is for me. And we say, well, great, you know. We were concerned about the kid themselves, not about a head count.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes right down to it, there'll probably always be some people out there. There's never going to be a whole lot. But there'll be some people out there who will want to play jazz on a serious basis. A lot of times people will ask questions like, well, man, what can be done to make jazz more popular? Well, if it becomes more popular, it's likely not to be jazz, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, what more would you like to record? What project is ahead for you, you know, I mean, that you're hoping to make a reality before you hang up your piano?
Well, there's some music of James Black that I'd like to record. Some more of it.
The New Orleans drummer,
right.
James Black.
Because mm-hmm. He's got a lot of mixed meter stuff, and some we already play. Also, I'd like to do some of Howard Silver's music. There's one called Moon Rays that I really love. Horace had a whole career of quintet music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since I have a quintet, I'll record as much as I can
mm-hmm.
for as long as I can, because I don't know how long I'm going to have a quintet.
Are you writing your own music?
To a certain extent. When I say that, what I mean is, I haven't really developed a compositional flair, so to speak. I've arranged three spirituals, which have no jazz sounds in them at all, which is by design. And I may do more of that.
And
but
so,
I've been working on a curriculum, and I'm still doing it.
So you're working on a curriculum to continue teaching? I thought you were retired from teaching.
But that has nothing to do with me working on a curriculum.
Okay, so how would you like your curriculum to be used?
By people who are still teaching. Because I think that there's too many things in jazz pedagogy that's missing.
What about pedagogy for the music lover who wants to know more about modern jazz? I mean, do you have any recommendations for what that person should be listening to?
No.
No?
You can't just say, okay, what's a good jazz song to listen to? You know, if it's really a jazz song, any of them, all of them will do. The point is, will the music that you enjoy listening to speak to you and subsequently lead you in that direction? You know, people hear something and it leads them beyond where they are.
That's right. But you don't want to leave a few breadcrumbs for the people?
I wouldn't know how to do that. I remember when my granddaughter was considering being a singer, I sent her an email. I said, all right, I want you to get this recording called Here's to Life by Shirley Horn.
Wow.
I said, I want you to take each one of them pieces and write out the lyrics. And once you do that, you go back and you start to listen to what the words say to you.
Where do you start? How do you separate the present from the past? How do you deal with all the things you thought would last? That didn't last.
And so you appear to me, at least, to be first and foremost a teacher.
It's interesting you would say that. Now, somebody asked Delphio and Jason, how do you see your dad? Delphio said as a player, Jason said as a teacher.
But maybe that just means that you're you know what I mean, you're cut right down the middle, half player, half educator. I'm going to appeal now to your musical side, your performing side, and ask you if you'd like to take us out on a song, any song you choose. Ellis Marsalis, thank you so very much for your time and for your great generosity.
You're welcome.
Boy, you're a stout-hearted man.
Ellis Marsalis died in April of complications from the coronavirus. He was 85.
And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Lars Howell, Justin Armstrong, and Margaret Howes. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a full playlist of songs in this hour and for news of Ellis Marsalis' later work, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Pinkalope Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, Shop Nadine Blake, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax-deductible, thanks to our partnership with National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.